From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the terrorists who hate our freedom won by scaring us into a bunker. That's largely because of what happened in Paris. You know what happened. At least you know by now. But last Friday, as it unfolded on mainstream and social media, we were confronted with a tangle of truth and hysterics, expertise and rumor, with or without malice aforethought. Actually, we were in the studio when we first learned about Paris. Our phones buzzed in unison, Twitter notifications that kept on buzzing as we were putting the final touches on last week's show.
Turns out people were retweeting the Breaking News Consumer's Handbook we wrote 2 years ago after a mass shooting. It offers guidance on how to evaluate initial reports after such a crime, the sources, the journalistic jargon, general words to the wise. Point number four, there is almost never a second shooter. But acts of terrorism, though similar in many respects, do not follow the same arc of coverage as the rampages of deranged shooters in schools and shopping malls. For one thing, there often is a second shooter. In other words, there are reporting errors peculiar to terrorist attacks that, tragically, you ought to know. So we begin this show with yet another one of our Breaking News Consumer Handbooks, the Terrorism Edition. And we'll begin with the frequent use of a misleading word.
In the days following an attack like this, there is an urgent need to find the culprit, not just the group behind it, but the actual individual. We seem to crave a specific human target for our anger and fear, but we don't want it to be just anybody. As Politico's Jack Schaefer wrote this week, we want it to be a mastermind.
Breaking news this morning in France. Heavy gunfire and explosions in an early morning raid targeting the mastermind behind the Paris attacks.
Authorities say the alleged mastermind is a high-profile ISIS member.
Abdelhamid Abaoud, who we have been told at least since Monday, is the mastermind, the brain, the actual Belgian who went to Syria more than a year ago.
They had to find some evocative word that would rank the villainy of the organizer up there with Professor Moriarty or Hannibal Lecter or Ernst Blofeld from 007 movies. One of the reasons I think it's important for us to abandon the word mastermind is that there's nothing really ingenious about the mechanics of what they're doing. It's about as sophisticated as ordering a pizza. The operation is essentially gun running by French nationals, setting their watches, making sure their suicide vests are properly fitted, and executing a plan according to a stopwatch. They're using very rudimentary tools of murder.
You were talking about the use of the mastermind narrative and how it treats terrorism in pop culture. And you mentioned 24, in which the forces of good predictably vanquish the forces of evil in each series finale.
When you think about a show like 24, if all the terrorists were really stupid, always blowing themselves up and always missing their buses, no one would be compelled to watch such a television show. For the drama to work, the villain must be absolutely diabolical. And we see that again and again in the way that Hollywood and book publishing portrays villains. They know everything. They anticipate every countermeasure that the hero is going to take. But in real life, they're not these colossuses. They're just working class guys whose job is to kill themselves while killing others.
Well, what happens in real life politics when we overestimate the genius of these guys?
Well, I think we strike out blindly, wildly. In the case of the 9/11 slaughter, we ended up invading Iraq and shouldn't have. But we wisely invaded Afghanistan, which was the territorial source of the planning and the logistics of the operation. Terror causes us to lose our senses. That's what the enemy is hoping. And I don't want to be one of those guys who says, oh, right now we're doing exactly what ISIS wants us to do. We're overreacting. But I guess I am going to be that guy. We've got to be careful to maintain our rationality in the face of what is an irrational horror that's taken place.
One last question, Jack. You wrote, when we turn the bad guy into a mastermind, We're offering ourselves an oddly false comfort, a way to make sense of a world that is neither as full of evil geniuses as the TV version would have us believe, nor as comforting.
Yeah. You know, the only way that I can wrap my mind around this is to think of it as a dumb war, a dumb, bloody war that the terrorists seem to be engaging in. So there's no reason for us to glorify it or dress it up or pin sequins on it as the product of brilliance. It also puts into perspective exactly who we're fighting, somebody who's not very bright, but absolutely tenacious and ruthless, not only in terms of who they kill, but how they die themselves.
Jack, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jack Schaefer is Politico's senior media writer.
Mastermind is one word to watch out for. Unprecedented is another. TV experts pose another hazard. So does passion and politics. J.M. Berger is co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. J.M., welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
Whenever a fresh attack occurs, we seem to forget everything that has ever happened before in all of human history.
Yeah, well, we remember 9/11 and Pearl Harbor. So when the Paris attacks were taking place, a lot of people were saying this is the worst terrorist attack in the West since 9/11. But in 2004, the Madrid subway attacks were more deadly, although arguably less disruptive. Remember that there's very little that happens in the realm of terrorism that's genuinely new. Even the 9/11 attacks had precursors. There were things in the past that sort of pointed to that. So you should always take a grain of salt when you hear somebody say something is new and unprecedented. So one thing that has frustrated me in a lot of this coverage is that there's been a great deal of talk about ISIS having new capabilities. In the case of the Paris attacks, there was definitely prior evidence to suggest that this was well within ISIS's reach.
Terrorism is just a magnificent opportunity for a certain kind of opportunistic politics. Is there anything we can do to protect ourselves?
Well, we can certainly try and keep some sense of perspective first. Terrorist attacks generally are not an existential threat. They are serious. We should treat them seriously and respond to them. But, you know, I think Lindsey Graham said last week that ISIS is coming here to kill us all, and they're not going to be able to do that. Secondly, we either hugely overestimate them or hugely underestimate them. They're either defeating us or they're no harm. So we say, oh, they're contained, or, oh, we don't think they have the capability to strike in the West, which many people said prior to this attack. And both things were kind of demonstrably untrue. So, you know, when we overestimate them, we're doing them a favor because we're making them look bigger than they are. And when we underestimate them, we're doing them a favor because when they do something that we didn't expect, everybody freaks out.
Wall-to-wall coverage following a terror attack means that cable news channels have to fill a lot of time with a lot of talking heads. Presented as somehow expert, are they always experts?
Well, you know, there are people who are certainly more qualified to talk about this than others. You know, I was struck while watching CNN's coverage of Paris that they were running a promo for a special by Fareed Zakaria that was going to explain where the Islamic State came from, and the most prominent person featured in that promo was Tom Friedman, who is not the first person I would go to for that explanation.
He's not a terrorism expert.
He's more of a generalist, and we need generalists in our public discourse, but there are also people who can sort of drill down into this. So it's a challenge cable channels have in filling those chairs, but at the same time, I hear some of the stuff they say and I just shake my head.
And from the Where Are They Now file, we give you this.
Former Vice President Dan Quayle on what he would do to address this growing ISIS threat.
The Chiron should have said, who cares what Dan Quayle thinks we should do? Dan Quayle?
When you're looking for somebody to fill that seat, as the cover stretches on, then you start looking further afield. So you look for people with strong or possibly entertaining political opinions. If you've ever worked for the CIA, then you're qualified to comment on ISIS. It doesn't matter if you spent 20 years in Guatemala, they'll call you up.
How do we separate the wheat from the chaff?
I think you look for people who are sober and who have access to facts.
Do you mean sober as in non-histrionic or sober as in not actually drunk?
Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. The more emotional the argument, the more questions you should have about it. And we saw this with Al-Qaeda to some extent, too. But I think ISIS even more really has captured the theater of terrorism like no other group has. Look for a coherent version of the facts. Check other sources. And one thing that was pretty striking in the hours and days after Paris was really just the unbelievably conflicting statements of fact. You know, one day we were saying that ISIS, you know, has never shown the capability to do this before. And next day it's like, we should have known this from the beginning. Sometimes the same person saying both things.
JM, thank you very much.
Thank you.
JM Berger is co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. We'll be hearing from him again later on in the show.
And now the Twitter part. Obviously, our instant link to the world can deepen both our insight and our ignorance. Joanne Stocker is a managing editor for Grasswire, a site that uses crowdsourcing to fact-check breaking news. She saw a heap of false messages and faked photos shared during last week's attack. Some were well-meant, others not. For instance, one viral picture claimed to show one of the attackers. Except it wasn't a suicide bomber. It was just a man, as it happens a Sikh, who was photoshopped to look like one.
And he was holding an iPad and taking a selfie in his bathroom, and they photoshopped that into a Quran, and they photoshopped a suicide vest on him. And, you know, they were spreading that around as this is one of the Paris attackers. They even photoshopped his eyebrows so that he looked angry. There was a sex toy photoshopped on the bathtub behind him, like really badly done. But if you're in the heat of the moment and you see this come across and it's, oh my God, you know, this guy's one of the attackers, people don't actually stop and look at it with that critical eye for the most part. They just reflexively hit retweet.
And of course, social media is subject to the same problem that all media are subject to, which is that once a lie is out there, it's almost impossible to take it back.
Right. Nobody reads retractions. So we took his actual photo from August.
The Sikh?
Yes, which is just a nice selfie, and juxtaposed it with the bad one with a giant red X over it. And we actually tweeted those together so that you were seeing both of them at once. It's almost like that old matching game, you know, circle what's different in the two photos. And then it was like, oh, well, yeah, of course this is fake.
You just hit on something fascinating. It was widely shared, your correction, and maybe it's because you gamified it.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to do, is make it as compelling as the fake photos. You know, because everybody remembers Hurricane Sandy. There were pictures of sharks swimming in the streets of New Jersey, which is just ridiculous, right? But, like, that picture looks cool, so people want to share that. And I think that if you can take the truth and actually present it in the same way, then you can actually inform people in a way that they're going to want to pass it on.
So if you were to isolate one particular breaking news consumer's handbook in the wake of a terrorist attack for Twitter users, what would it be?
My favorite thing in the breaking news consumer's handbook is the first one. In the immediate aftermath, news outlets will get it wrong. And if you want to take that into Twitter and say, you know, in the immediate aftermath, the reports are going to be messy and you have to give them time. You know, you have to give the authorities and the witnesses and the media in general time, because governments are going to get it wrong and the media is going to get it wrong and witnesses are going to get it wrong. And it doesn't mean that there's a conspiracy. It just means that this is breaking news.
What do you anticipate in terms of falsity in the reporting that we'll be seeing further out from the event?
Scapegoating. You know, they're already talking about the refugee issue. There was a passport that, you know, miraculously survived one of the suicide attacks that was found. And they said that that passport had come through Greece. And so this is a Syrian refugee. We need to be careful because, you know, somebody came here as a refugee and committed this act. And then it turned out, I think it was 2 days later, that they arrested somebody in Serbia who's had the same passport. The picture was different, but all of the other data was the same.
So the passport was faked.
It's almost certain. I think that we have a human need for answers. We need to know who did this. And sometimes saying it's Daesh or it's ISIS isn't enough. We need that face. This person did it and they are from Belgium. This person did it and they're from Syria. What's so dangerous about it is once you've got that person's face in your head or their name, it's so hard to replace that with the accurate information. And then we get nervous. Well, you told me that it was this guy, and now you're telling me that it's this other guy. We start to trust government a little bit less, and we start to trust the media a little bit less. And I think that that makes us feel that we're more insecure than we really are.
Joanne, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was really nice to talk to you.
Joanne Stocker is the managing editor for GrassWire.
Those are the components of the Breaking News Consumer's Handbook Terrorism Edition. You can find a link to a handy one-page version at onthemedia.org. For the rest of the show, we considered the words, the memes, and the misdirection that muddied the media and our perspectives on Islam and the Arab world.
The Paris articles were really intimate. We knew about the places where it happened. We knew that there was a rock band playing. There was no mention in Beirut of the school, the hospital, the crowded marketplace that was near this explosion.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the wake of the Paris attacks, the discussion of America's fight against ISIS has taken on a new tone of urgency. And greater urgency means greater involvement. And in the U.S., greater involvement has its very own synecdoche.
We didn't put a single boot on the ground, and Gaddafi was deposed.
I will not put American boots on the ground in Syria.
Many will look at it and say, you've broken your promise about boots on the ground.
Boots on the ground, a vivid demarcation of one kind of warfare escalating into something more dangerous and expensive and complicated. But the term turns out to be rather ambiguous. Kathy Gilsonan is a senior editor at The Atlantic. She covers global affairs. She says the phrase has been used to blur the definition of war in the public consciousness. Kathy, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
What constitutes boots on the ground? In Syria, we have so-called advisors there, and in Iraq, we have special ops forces there. Here was President Obama in 2015.
Really, this is just an extension of what we were continuing to do. We are not putting U.S. troops on the front lines fighting firefights with ISIL.
But they are military, and they have guns, and I don't think they're in flip-flops. Why isn't that already boots on the ground?
Back in 2013, the first time we started talking about intervening forcefully in Syria was the aftermath of the chemical weapons attack, which Obama had said was a red line that would dictate some other kind of response. But he did say that the U.S. was not contemplating putting boots on the ground. So I think part of the reason he's trying not to use the phrase now is so that it doesn't sound as if he's broken this promise not to put U.S. boots on the ground. The soldiers that are being deployed, they have what's called an advise and assist mission. They're not meant to be directly battling ISIS on the front lines. They're meant to be in a facilitation role to train local indigenous forces to take the fight to ISIS. Now, the fact that these troops don't have a combat mission per se does not preclude their engaging in combat from time to time.
The key seems to be very few U.S. ground personnel in harm's way. But we've run more than 4,000 bombing missions in Syria. There weren't any Japanese boots on the ground at Pearl Harbor, for crying out loud. If this isn't war, what is it then? Fun size?
I think that's the very important question. And this is why I've been interested in this term to begin with. The nature of the debate surrounding American involvement in Iraq and Syria really does seem to use another cliche, draw a red line at a massive invasion and ground occupation. But what gets lost in that discussion is the fact that the United States has been waging war on ISIS from the air. People in Iraq and Syria know that there's a war going on.
Now, is it your sense that this was a useful figure of speech that has been embraced for its political convenience because it is so ambiguous? Like, for example, enhanced interrogation tactics. It was deployed specifically to fuzz the issue for the public.
Well, It's an interesting question, and I wouldn't want to attribute a high level of cynicism to people I haven't myself interviewed. In the military context, the way that the term was meant to be used was to distinguish between people who were in transit to the area of operations versus actually physically on the ground. So you'll notice there's no distinction regarding the nature of the mission. Now, I think it's an evocative phrase, but there are risks to using it. Martin O'Malley, the Democratic presidential candidate, brought up in the debate that he was approached by a mother in Iowa who said, "Listen, I need you guys to stop using this term, boots on the ground. That's my son. That's a human who's in those shoes." And it does have this effect of sort of dehumanizing these actual humans that we send to war. I also think the meaning of the term matters to the extent that it is seen as this threshold of when we're really at war. But we've been bombing the place for over a year. How is that not a war?
So, Kathy, I don't want to discount decoding language to understand politics. But at this stage of crisis, especially in Europe, is semantics really what we should be talking about?
Well, let me put it to you this way. I think there's a hunger now, especially now in the wake of the Paris attacks, now that we're all paying attention, to be able to answer this question, what exactly is the United States doing in Iraq and Syria? And I think that the semantic confusion is a symptom of the inadequacy of the explanations that U.S. citizens have been offered about whether or not they are, in fact, at war.
Kathy, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Kathy Gilsonan is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where she covers global affairs.
Just prior to the Paris attack, over 40 were killed and more than 200 wounded in two suicide bombings in the neighborhood of Borej al-Barajaneh in southern Beirut. ISIS claimed credit and then a day later attacked Paris. And that sparked a huge reaction on both mainstream and social media. For a while, the world seemed bedecked in the French flag. But amid the displays, a question was raised and raised again. Why Paris and not Beirut? Why didn't the global media mourn for victims in Lebanon? Habib Bataa, founder of BeirutReport.com, both asked and answered the question in a post for Al Jazeera. He said for him, it started with a symbol of solidarity that wasn't.
Some Lebanese news sites had posted a picture of the Sydney Opera House lit up with a Lebanese flag. And people had spread this around saying, oh, isn't that nice that, you know, Australia is mourning Lebanese victims because there's so many Lebanese immigrants living in Australia. It turned out that the photo was a photoshopped fake. But I think it really underscored the fact that, sadly, there was no semblance of mourning for Beirut on the scale that France had been mourned.
Now, you noted that the coverage of the two events were not equal. Some journalists, like Max Fischer in Vox, chafe at the charge that the Beirut attacks weren't reported. He said it was covered extensively in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the AP, CNN, The Economist, even the Daily Mail. It's just, he says, that their audiences really don't care about mass acts of violence outside the West.
It's not really about the number of articles. It's really about how the articles are written, the framing and the adjectives that are used to describe the victims, for example. The Paris articles were really intimate. We knew about the places where it happened. We knew that there was a rock band playing. You know, some people might identify with that. We knew that there was a stadium and a cafe. But in Beirut, there were almost no quotes, actually, from the victims. There was no mention in Beirut of the school, the hospital, the crowded marketplace that was near this explosion. That kind of rich detail was missing from the initial reporting. The reports overwhelmingly focused on the geopolitical aspects. You know, this is a Hezbollah territory. These people are just kind of pawns in a geopolitical conflict.
And specifically, you pointed to the language used to describe the neighborhood there as a Hezbollah stronghold. like this.
The bombers struck a Hezbollah stronghold in southern Beirut. Hezbollah has been fighting ISIS in Syria.
43 people are killed in two suicide blasts in a Hezbollah stronghold in southern Beirut.
This neighborhood is a stronghold of Hezbollah, the Lebanese militia fighting alongside Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria.
And that's actually kind of adopting the language of ISIL itself, which is saying that, you know, these aren't people, these are Hezbollah people. They're kind of part of this war, so they kind of deserve it almost. So I think that really colors our perception. Is it just a tragedy, or is it a tragedy that's really kind of understandable?
And you notice that the language in the New York Times headline changed twice. First it was, blast hits Hezbollah's stronghold in Beirut, killing dozens, worst bombing in years. Then, deadly blast hits Hezbollah area in southern Beirut. And then finally, deadly blast hits crowded neighborhood in southern Beirut.
There has been this ongoing discussion about the term stronghold for the past couple years or so. People have complained very loudly about it. So I think that pressure did play a role here. The New York Times itself ends up doing a whole new Beirut story 2 days later, almost like a complete retake, where they really drastically change their tone and start interviewing the victims. You had this influx from, you know, CNN to Time Magazine, and the New York Times and others, who basically went ahead and did reports quoting a lot of this critiques and quoting even bloggers who actually raised this issue as well. So Beirut kind of in this case has come to symbolize a discussion now about why do we care more about Western lives? And I think that the broader impact of that is our lack of compassion for other parts of the world. But then on the other hand, we had a lot of articles that came out more recently kind of saying, well, it's the reader's fault, kind of very defensive point of view, saying that, you know, we kind of reject this critique and you people don't want to read about world news. That's why we don't publish it on our websites. I mean, we have a system set up where our media is dominated by infotainment and a lot of space is taken up by celebrities.
All right, we've all heard those critiques, but let me just drill down past the triviality of our media and all of that down to the level of empathy you referred to. We are wired to care about our own. We care about what's familiar to us. There's a perception of Beirut in the West, of a city that is far away and always at war. And maybe Western news consumers and journalists expect attack in Beirut, but they don't in Paris. And they're also familiar with the idea of Paris. People care about what they recognize. The media reflect that. How do you get around that feedback loop? Because you can write those stories over and over and over again, and the result may just be fatigue. Do you have an answer to this?
Maybe we have to look at how we can be more innovative in our storytelling. We can also look how we can connect our audience to those living in foreign countries. Instead of, you know, writing about them as pawns in a political game, maybe we can kind of look at them like we look at our own citizens and try to find those same stories. You know, there's also stories of heroism and the Beirut bombing where a man tackled a suicide bomber.
Adil Termos, a father of two who threw himself at the second suicide bomber who was approaching a mosque. This was actually covered by CNN.
It was. It took a little while. But there are probably a lot of Adil Termos in other countries, and you know, in Pakistan and Africa. Maybe we don't even know about them. But the more connected we are, the more people have a channel to talk back to the media when they have actually messed up. We are seeing a richer environment, a richer kind of give and take. It is encouraging to see that some media are starting to take this conversation seriously.
Habib, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Habib Bhatta is a Beirut-based journalist who runs BeirutReport.com.
We're back now with J.M. Berger, co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror, this time to discuss media and ISIS from the other direction, its very own magazine, Dabiq. English-language magazines promoting jihadism aren't new. They've been around since the Soviet-Afghan War of the 1980s. But like other elements of ISIS's propaganda arm, Dabiq is particularly slick.
They have now put out 12 issues, distributed online as a PDF. It looks like a commercial magazine. It is filled with often very canny articles about the state of their caliphate, sort of crafting the utopian image of the society they're building, while at the same time including a lot of threats against the West and the outside world.
Well, on the subject of freakoutability, it's called Dabiq because that is the site of the final apocalypse.
Yeah, Dabiq is a town in Syria where they expect an important battle in the apocalypse to take place. They will battle Rome on the hills of Dabiq. And one of the beheading videos from last year ended with Jihadi John saying, "We wait for you in Dabiq."
Is there any way that the very existence of Dabiq can help intelligence organizations track down the very people they want to keep their eye on?
Well, we can get some information out of it. I mean, ISIS is pretty careful about what information it gives away online. As with all of ISIS's propaganda and all of its social media activities, there's a balance between the intelligence we can get out of it versus the benefit that it has for ISIS. Dabiq is mostly benefit for ISIS, but occasionally you'll find something that might be actionable. But it's better for really kind of understanding their priorities and where they might be going next.
One of the things that struck me in Dabiq is a feature called "In the Words of the Enemy." And people like me who have a news alert for their names on Google, a little pathetic, I grant you, it amuses me that even ISIS is concerned what people are saying about it.
ISIS is happy to show how much fear they can strike in their enemies and how much their enemies hate them. So a couple of months back, they featured a couple of American politicians, including Rick Santorum and a Virginia state senator who had said scary things about ISIS. And what was kind of shocking and appalling to me was they were like proud of this. So like these guys would send out tweets like, "Look, ISIS thinks I know what they're about, so I must know what they're about." I aspire not to be quoted in ISIS propaganda.
Mm-hmm. And you've succeeded till now.
A lot of my colleagues have ended up in the pages of In the Words of the Enemy. It's difficult to avoid saying something that they can twist around to their benefit. I've always tried to embed an insult anytime I talk about a positive capability they have. But, you know, I don't know if I can dodge that bullet forever.
Wait. You embed insults so that they can't use your quote. Now, this is an organization that has killed thousands of people in the most gruesome fashion and is pitiless. You think they're going to be more scrupulous than Hollywood is doing movie blurbs that they're going, "Oh my God, what are we going to do? He said this nice thing, but he put an insult in there. They'll cut the insult out, won't they, JM?"
I don't know. It's worked so far. I mean, you know, yeah, it's also kind of a game. You have to find a little bit of humor in this extremely grim subject when you can.
On the subject of what makes them feel like they're being glorified and what gets under their skin, there is also what we all call them. Some people say ISIS, others say ISIL, and still others say Daesh. ISIL and ISIS are acronyms for their name in English. Daesh is an acronym for their Arabic name, but is also deemed to be an insult. Why is that?
Well, you know, I've asked that question of a lot of Arabic speakers and never gotten a completely clear answer. Essentially, there's been some argument that it has some kind of scatological meaning, or it has some kind of imputation of stupidity, or it's just like a silly nonsense word that makes them uncomfortable. That's all well and good. I mean, I think there's been kind of this portentous embrace of the term by politicians and some of our military leaders. They think that they're like, "Nah, this is going to teach them. We're going to call them a name that they don't like." You know, a lot of this talk about the name is based on this idea that they can delegitimize them by not calling them the Islamic State. The problem is ISIS, ISIL, and Daesh all include the phrase Islamic State. So we're not really taking that away from them. I mean, if we call them a bunch of jerks, that would at least not have the phrase Islamic State embedded into it. I find it a little baffling.
I remember that George H.W. Bush in the first Iraq War insisted on calling Saddam Hussein Saddam, supposedly because he thought it would irritate the dictator. He did not immediately surrender power. There had to be some years of bombing and a ground invasion before he was dislodged.
name-calling is not likely to dislodge the Islamic State. And in fact, this sort of very self-important reference to them as Daesh, I think, gives them kind of a special status. You know, the Aryan nations, we call them the Aryan nations. That's what they call themselves. It doesn't mean that we're legitimizing their claim that the United States should be an Aryan nation. So when we bend over backwards not to legitimize, I put in quotes, ISIS by using the name that it uses for itself, it's kind of condescending in a way. It's saying that Muslims around the world aren't going to be able to distinguish this group from a real Islamic State because they call themselves the Islamic State. And I think that's kind of absurd.
J.M., once again, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
J.M. Berger is co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror.
Coming up, how we had evolved in our ability to distinguish between Islam and terrorism, and how Congress proved this week the theory of devolution.
I think the worst of these zombie ideas shuffling back from their grave is this idea of a clash of civilizations.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There is fear, and there is politics, and there is the politics of fear. And this week, we were inundated with all three. You may find this hard to believe, but aside from disclosing our own views to you, because you should have that information when considering our coverage, we work pretty hard not to flog them. That's because, believe it or not, we are more interested in seeing how things work than in preaching.
So at our Monday editorial meeting, we were talking about the situation in Paris and how we can look at it and what's the meaning of 9/11 as a metaphor and what is the meaning of boots on the ground and why is it used so often?
And I said, I have something to propose that is a little less semiotic in nature. I saw a cartoon in the Daily Mail. Syrian refugees in Bedouin clothing and sandals storming the borders of the EU with rats at their feet. Rats! It was just pure naked racism, like something out of Der Stürmer. And then, as I watched the news, I kept having that same feeling. Is this really where we are in 2015?
Because now we've got Donald Trump saying we should issue American Muslims IDs and track them on databases. We have Ben Carson saying Muslims should be barred from the presidency. And Ted Cruz saying that Muslim refugees should be barred from our borders and smoked out with a religion test. And Chris Christie saying that no one is too young to pose a threat.
The fact is that we need appropriate vetting, and I don't think orphans under five should be admitted into the United States at this point.
Yes, they're all Republicans. But John McCain pushed back on those ideas, while the Democratic mayor of Roanoke, Virginia, was busy praising FDR's infamous Japanese internment camps, which Republican Ronald Reagan eventually apologized for. And then on Thursday, 47 House Democrats helped pass a veto-proof bill to tighten the already strict requirements for the settlement of future refugees here. So this is, to a degree, a bipartisan reversion to paranoia.
It's an old story and a familiar one to anyone with a historical memory. Here's New York Congressman Gerald Nadler this week on WNYC.
If it weren't for the anti-Semitic, xenophobic 1924 Immigration Act, passed by an anti-Semitic xenophobic Congress, maybe 2 million of the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust would have been in New York instead, would have been in the United States instead. We shut our doors to people in need when they were Jewish. We can't do that again.
But we don't have to go back to the Second World War. We experienced the same panic, the same reflex, back after 2001. And Mark Lynch, professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, says we learned from it. We really did. And we recovered our nerve for a while.
We seem to have gone right past almost a decade of growth where we learned a lot of lessons, and we seem in many ways to be right back where we started, asking many of the same questions about what is the relationship between Islam and terrorism? Is it possible to have coexistence between Islam and the West? What I've been calling the endless recurrence of the clash of civilizations.
You suggest that maybe this post-Paris moment is worse than the post 9/11 one.
In some ways, it is worse because we have all of that history behind us. But at the same time, the kinds of ideas that you're seeing espoused by presidential candidates right now are the sorts of things that you would have seen on obscure right-wing blogs 12 years ago, and now they're being taken seriously on the op-ed pages. The idea that you would have a religious test for Syrian refugees to let Christians but not Muslims in, or that you would create a national registry to track Muslims or to shut down mosques, I mean, these are radical fringe ideas, and yet they've insinuated themselves into the mainstream. One of the things which is very interesting is that after 9/11, the Bush administration was actually very, very good at insisting repeatedly and publicly that America was not at war with Islam.
Actually, we have a clip of that from September 17th, 2001.
The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace. These terrorists don't represent peace. They represent evil and war.
He always pushed for this idea that Al-Qaeda was a marginal extremist group that was at war with the mainstream of Islam. And that was both, in my opinion, right, but also it was a very powerful message to the American body politic. After 9/11, the Bush administration served in many ways as a firewall against the spread of these really extreme ideas, because this popular Republican president was saying very clearly that Islam is part of America and that we are not at war with Islam.
Bush went to mosques. He hosted dinners. He stayed in touch with the community.
Exactly. When President Obama says more or less the exact same thing, it doesn't resonate in the same way. You know, the Republican Party seems to be in a very different place right now. 8 years or 7 years of the Obama administration and the evolution of the nature of the Republican Party.
I would say it's because of this election, because it always dumbs down the rhetoric.
Every election cycle tends to do that. But I think you have the combination of that, along with things that are actually happening over in the Middle East. They resonate with each other. Those horrifying videos of the beheadings of the American journalists, or when they burned the Jordanian pilot alive in a cage. These atrocities were some of the most watched news events of the entire year, and that really imprinted itself upon the consciousness.
Let's talk now about how that caused a lot of the evolution in our thinking to unravel over the last decade.
There's a number of questions which seem to have been resolved and that have now been reopened. So, for example, the idea that Islam is inherently violent or inherently hostile to Western values. This was debated back in the early 2000s and then largely resolved. And now a lot of those ideas are back.
We've got a clip of Republican candidate Marco Rubio on ABC reacting to Hillary Clinton's refusal to use the phrase radical Islam as what we're warring against during last Saturday's presidential debate.
That would be like saying we weren't at war with Nazis because we were afraid to offend some Germans who may have been members of the Nazi Party but weren't violent themselves.
I think that these kinds of rhetorical flourishes are just extremely dangerous.
Let me understand why it's dangerous. Is it because he's using the word Islam? Because he is qualifying it by radical.
If you're looking at groups like Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, they have a vision of a world which is divided between Islam and not Islam. They believe that it is basically not only impossible, but fundamentally wrong to have coexistence. The problem is that the overwhelming majority of the Muslims of the world don't agree with them. So their use of terrorism, their use of social media is designed to make it impossible for a Muslim to live in the West. And so I think we've seen, as a question of strategy for quite some time, the need to draw that sharp distinction and to say the jihadists, they're wrong. Actually, Islam is compatible with the West, to kind of isolate them and marginalize them. The dangers with this mainstreaming of the ideas about a war on radical Islam is that it creates then this slippery slope towards affirming the ideology that Al-Qaeda is espousing, basically saying, yeah, you're right. You can't coexist. That is the true Islam. That's what makes it so dangerous.
I think that it would be a lot easier for people to understand why using the phrase radical Islam doesn't work is if you replaced it with radical Christianity.
You know, a few months ago, I was asked to testify to the House Armed Services Committee about how to combat the Islamic State. And this was just a few days after the murder of several young American Muslims down in North Carolina. At the time, what I said was it was so important that our discussions about American Muslims focus on people like them, wonderful young people who were raising money for Syrian refugees, living these lives full of hope, rather than on ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And in the days after that, a clip of my talk apparently went viral, and I received hundreds, if not thousands, of emails from American Muslims saying thank you because they feel so under siege in this political and media environment. This is just one very small thing, but to me, it's emblematic of how much things seem to have changed. And I would just like to see the media and politicians, even academics like myself, avoiding the easy rhetoric and trying to keep that sense of what holds us together. But right now, everything seems to be pulling us apart instead.
Is there something about the news media today, as opposed to 14 years ago, that enables this kind of backsliding?
You know, I think there is. And I think you really see the cultivation of these more extremist types of views nurtured and shaped within these very insular online communities of the like-minded. And then those now bleed very effortlessly up into the broadcast media. And now the news, the opinion, the flow of images and information, so much of it goes through social media first, and then it is reflected back out from the broadcast media.
I think you're right. I mean, go back to the period immediately after 9/11 and for years thereafter. There was this huge rumbling up from some precincts of the internet that persists that says, we bombed ourselves on 9/11. I don't know that that idea ever made it into mainstream news.
But today it probably would. It would become this idea that was circulating, which was retweeted thousands of times, which would be picked up by a cable news host. It would be reported, and then suddenly those ideas, they've jumped from that little community into the national discourse. And I think we see a lot of that these days.
What is the rhetorical blast from the past that bothers you the most?
I think the worst of these zombie ideas shuffling back from their grave is this idea of a clash of civilizations, that the real problem is Islam and that there's this fundamental divide between Muslims and the rest of us, partly analytically because it's not right and we know how many divisions there are within the Muslim world. It's also strategically important, I think, to recognize that the jihadists are a tiny minority and you don't want to give them the power that they seek by anointing them the spokesman of an authentic Islam. For me, though, it's also kind of a human issue. I mean, the vast majority of the Muslims of the world, they're just ordinary people. They're living lives. They have jobs. They have families. And in a sense, this idea of a clash of civilizations, it just wipes them off the map, right? It denies their entire existence. And to be honest, I have a very difficult time wrapping my head around the idea that so many people believe this to be true when everything in my experience says that it's not.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Mark Lynch is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University and contributing editor to the Washington Post blog, The Monkey Cage.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland and Dasha Lizitsina, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.